So we'll try to locate him and let y'all know in case you miss someone to listen. All right. Well, I'll do a little review. It's funny, I was thinking about you saying that last week. She said that this is a different kind of a class. It feels different. This lesson on Hebrews feels like somebody else maybe wrote it. I don't know. Does it feel that way to the rest of you? Does it feel kind of... what I came to is that maybe it's because it's a little bit more topical for a book study. It breaks it down more into topics, and so we don't... It's not so much a going through verse by verse as it is trying to keep up with all the cross-references and the different topics that it comes. That's kind of what I think, being that it's the kind of book that it is, which is a little bit different, maybe, Hebrews is. Yeah. Right, yeah. It is a little bit, just the book of Hebrews itself, I think, is a little bit different. And we don't know who the writer is, so it could be he just has a whole different style, which makes for a different kind of book. But nevertheless, it will continue that way. So. It's not going to change. All right. Well, I was thinking about Hebrews and thinking about as we review this and how does the book of Hebrews open? What's the opening verse of the book of Hebrews? Think back to Hebrews chapter 1.
Well, God spoke to us in many ways and fashions.
Yeah. Yeah, in former times, God spoke to the prophets in many ways. And I was thinking, if you go back and all the prophets that we've studied, and you look at how, and the word of the Lord came to this one, and the word of the Lord came to this one, and the word of the Lord came to this one. He spoke to them in visions and in dreams and, you know, all kinds of ways. And then the last one you find is in Luke chapter 2, I believe, or chapter 3 with John the Baptist. And it says in Luke chapter 3, verse 2, the word of God came to John, the son of Zacharias, in the wilderness. And so he was really the last prophet, wasn't he, John the Baptist? He was the last one. And then we go to John chapter 1. I've got black fingers already. John chapter 1, it says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And then we know that, and the Word became flesh, in verse 14, and dwelt among us. And we beheld his glory, glories of the only begotten from the Father, full of grace and truth. And so God spoke to the prophets all the way through. And then how did he speak according to John chapter 1? His son, the Word actually became flesh and dwelt among us. And so it wasn't just what Jesus said. It was his very person that God spoke through. Everything about him, his character, his mission here, his high priesthood, his everything that we've looked at in Hebrews is how God is speaking through his son. It's everything, his work of redemption, the fact that he not only made propitiation, he is the propitiation for our sins. You know, he's the sacrifice. He's the sacrifice lamb. And so everything about him is how God has spoken through his son. And so as we go through Hebrews, we know that we see that he is better than anything else, don't we? We start off by seeing he's better than who? In the beginning of Hebrews. Okay, the angels. And that was important because when God spoke the law, he spoke it through the mediation of angels. And so they had the law lifted up here, apparently, we know they did. And he says, you know, the speaker of this new covenant is much, much better than those angels. The angels are only what? What are they?
Ministers.
Yeah, they're ministers. They're servants. And they're servants, ultimately, of who? Of us, that God has given them to be our servants on our behalf to help us. They minister to those who will inherit salvation. And so they are our ministers, but they are God's servants. And Jesus is not just, he's not a servant. What is he? He's the son, yeah. And we saw the difference between Moses and Jesus, that Moses was a servant in whose house? In God's house. And Jesus was what? Okay, son over his own house, right? And we are part of that house if we do what? Hold fast. Right, hold fast our confession to the end. Of course, we saw that all the way through the book of Revelation, there were those who were the overcomers and all the promises made to them. If you hold fast, if you hold fast. Here it's holding fast, holding on, paying attention. And so as we go through the book of Hebrews, then he encourages them because he wrote the book of Hebrews, this letter, to encourage these Hebrews, because they were apparently discouraged, right? They need to be encouraged, and they were being discouraged because they were suffering what? Okay, there was some persecution, and they were discouraged, and they were thinking about going back into Judaism, to the law. And he says, don't go back. That was only a what? What was that? A picture. It's a picture of everything that was to come in this last one that Jesus, that God has spoken through. And so God is still speaking through his son, and everything about him, that was just a picture of a shadow of what was to come. And so don't go back. Don't go back. And so he's encouraging them to do what? Well, that's the first warning he gave them. His warnings are kind of woven in with the encouragements, aren't they? He's telling them to hold fast. Okay, don't drift. Yeah, first he says, listen to his voice in chapter 2. Don't neglect the salvation, because if God is speaking through his son, and his son is the final word, is there any salvation outside of him? No. So don't neglect the salvation he's put before you, because if you do, there's nothing else. There's nothing else. And then in chapter 3 through chapter 4, what's the warning that he gives them? Okay, if you hear his voice today, if you hear his voice, don't harden your hearts. So who's the example that he holds up for them not to follow? Okay, the Israelites in the day of who particularly? Okay, in the day of Moses. And he talks about what they were like when they were wandering in the wilderness. And what were they like? Okay, they complained. What was that? They mumbled. They tested God. They tested him to prove that he was evil. They weren't testing him to prove that he was good. They were testing him to prove that he was not. And he says, don't be like them. Don't be like them. They're a great example. Don't follow them. Yeah.
What does that mean? Like, prove it to me because we don't believe you and we don't think you'll come through. Is that what that
yeah.
is?
Yeah. They weren't testing. Like, God tells us to test him. But it's to test him to prove that he is good. But they were testing him in a sense to prove that he was evil, so that he was not going to follow through on his promise. He was not going to provide for them. He was not going to get them to the land. He was not going to, you know, all the things he said, that they're kind of testing him to prove that he was not who he said he was.
And when doing the Genesis 3 study on the life of Abraham, you see God's testing him to show Abraham what was in him that God already knew.
What was in Abraham? Yes. Mm-hmm.
Because we don't know what we have in us as far as faith goes. It takes the test. Testing.
Okay. And Abraham, what an example. We're going to look at him this week, and he's such a great example. And God tests us, and he tests us even in the furnace. He'll put us in the furnace to burn off the dross to show that there is gold in there and there is something of value. But they were not, that wasn't their testing. So he says, don't be like them. If you don't act like them, don't be unbelieving like them. Don't test God like they did. Don't harden your hearts, because they were unbelieving and hardened their hearts. And then in chapter 6, he tells them what? What was the warning there? Okay, don't fall away, because there were some that had fallen away. And what was the outcome for them? So there's no way to renew them to repentance. To these, whoever these were that had fallen away, we're not going to get back into that again, whoever they were not, there's no hope of renewal to repentance, whatever that meant. Okay, and they were shaming the Son of God. And so the warnings that he gave them had to do with repentance, had to do with holding fast, persevering, not falling away, and growing up, right? They had gotten stuck, hadn't they? They had gone backward, and they were not grown-ups anymore in the faith. They had become babies, and they needed to have the milk. And we know that there's places in the Word where it talks about the milk being what we should desire, but this is a different slant on them. They couldn't handle the solid food anymore. They needed to have only the milk, and they needed to grow up and move on and press to maturity. And that's a good word for us, isn't it? As we think about this book, and we think about the encouragement to them, that we don't have the temptation to go back to Judaism, perhaps, but we need to all be encouraged to grow up. And we grow up by effort, right? Because God has promised that he is completing the work that he has started in us, but we have responsibility in that, don't we? We have responsibility to press on, to eat the meat of the Word, to have our senses trained to discern good and evil by the Word. We can't expect him to do it all for us. Just like the baby you have, and the baby is set into that baby's life, that it will grow. The body will grow. The thing about that baby will grow. but there's responsibility as that baby grows for him to participate in the growth process as well. So there we go. All right, so as we look then at chapter 6, we saw that, of course, the warning there, and as we got to verse 10, he was telling them that he had confidence in them. The fruit that was coming out of their little field of their life was not for naught. It wasn't weeds and tares and thorns, but it was fruitful. And he says in verse 10, as he's convinced of better things concerning them, for God is not unjust so as to forget your work and the love which you have shown toward his name in having ministered and still ministering to the saints. So there was some fruit in their life, wasn't there? Whether this was, it was past and it seems like it was continuing on because they had done this and still were doing this. So there was some fruit. Maybe it wasn't a lot of fruit. Maybe it wasn't as much fruit as he hoped to see, but there was some. There was value in what they were producing in their little garden. And so he tells them then in verse 11, we desire that each one of you, so he's talking to them collectively, but then individually, each one of you, every single one of you, show the same diligence so as to realize the full assurance of hope until the end. There's that again, that looking toward the end, right? We're going to persevere to the end. We're going to hope until the end. It's not just for today. It's looking forward so that you will not be what? Sluggish. Don't be slugs. But instead of being slugs, be imitators. It takes some work to be an imitator, doesn't it? Because what do you have to do to be an imitator? Okay, you have to observe. You have to pick out the people, first of all, that you want to imitate. You have to be looking and be searching and looking for godly qualities in people's lives. And as you see those, then you observe them and you watch and then you do the work to become an imitator. So there's some work there. So you're not sluggish, but you're working hard. You're being imitators of those who through faith and patience inherit the promises. And then he's going to give them an example, isn't he? Who's the example he's going to give? Abraham. And we're going to know, with to Hebrews 11, he's going to give him lots of examples. But this is the one he's going to focus on, is Abraham. Now, why would he tell them particularly about Abraham? Why would they know about Abraham? Okay, Father Abraham, right? They knew about Father Abraham. He was integral to the Hebrew heritage. They knew about him. God made the covenant with Abraham. Because of that, they were all shares in that, and so they knew about him. It says, be imitators of those who through faith and patience inherit the promise. And then he goes on to talk about Abraham. So we're going to look at Abraham a little bit here. I'm just going to read these couple verses, then we'll look at the part in Genesis where it talks about Abraham. It says, for when God made the promise to Abraham, since he could swear by no one greater, he swore by himself, saying, I will surely bless you and I will surely multiply you. And so, having patiently waited, now you go back to verse 12, here it is, patiently waited, he did what? He obtained the promise. And so he tells them to watch for those who through faith and patience inherit the promise. And so Abraham is the perfect example of that. For men swear by no one greater than themselves, or swear by one greater than themselves, and with an oath given as confirmation is an end of every dispute. In the same way, God, desiring even more to show to the heirs of the promise the unchangeableness of his purpose, interposed with an oath, so that by two unchangeable things, in which it is impossible for God to lie, we who have taken refuge would have strong encouragement to take hold of the hope set before us. This hope we have is an anchor of the soul, a hope both sure and steadfast, and one which enters within the veil, where Jesus has entered as a forerunner for us, having become a high priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek. And so we're going to look at this and look at Abraham and see what we can learn from his story. So the first passage we see about Abraham was in Genesis chapter 12. What do we see there? Okay, what's the story of though first? What does it say? Who is Abraham anyway? Do we know anything about Abraham before we find him on the scene in verse in chapter 12 of Genesis?
Oh, that's when he was in Ur.
Okay, but we don't know anything about him, do we? We really don't know anything about Abraham. He just kind of pops up. We know that he's the son of Terah, and he lives in Ur of the Chaldees, which is Babylon, I believe. And what do we know about the people during that time? Well, they worshipped idols, didn't they? They were, you think of Babylon and idol worship, and he is amidst all of that, and we know that God just calls him, right? So chapter 12, what does the Lord say to Abram? This person that we don't know really anything about, but God does, doesn't he? So what does he tell him? Okay, so first he's to go forth, right? He's to go forth from his country and from his
people.
Yeah, from his people, from his relatives, from his father's house. And he's supposed to go where? Okay, he's going to go to the land that God shows him. God has a land picked out, and he's going to take Abram out of this Ur of the Chaldees, away from all this corrupting influence around him, take him out and take him to this land. And when he gets to the land, what's God going to do? Okay, he's going to be a great nation, he's going to be a blessing, he said, I'm going to bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing, and he will do what? Okay, so he's going to be a great nation. He's going to bless him. There's the land. He's taken to the land that God has for him. And he'll bless those who bless him and curse those who curse him. And it says, in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Okay, so God spoke to Abram. He told him, get out of here and go. I'm going to show you the land, and I'm going to bless you. I'm going to make you a great nation, and I'm going to make your name great. And so how old was Abram at this point?
75.
Okay, he was 75 years old, which isn't young. Even then, it wasn't young. And so the first promise God made him was to make him a great nation. What does that involve?
Having children.
Descendants, right? You had to have a descendant to have a great nation made of you. And so that's the first thing we think of, is that God had promised him a great nation, not just a nice family, but he promised to make him a great nation. And he was 75 years old, and he had no children, but who did he take with him? Okay, he took his nephew Lot with him, and of course his wife Sarai, and all the possessions and all the persons they had acquired, and they left for the land of Canaan. All right. So God called him, and he made some promises to him. Okay, then the next thing we see is Genesis chapter 13. And what is the story there? Okay, the separation from Lot. He brought Lot with him, his nephew Lot, and they went to the Negev, and Lot was with him. Now, what does it say about Abram? Okay, he was very rich. He had a lot of animals, a lot of silver, a lot of gold. I think that's the first mention in the Bible of silver and gold. Actually, I actually have that written in my margin. Okay, so he went, and Lot went with him, and he also had a lot of animals, didn't he? Lots of tents. And so what happened? Okay, and there was some tension between the servants of Lot and the servants of Abram. And so what did Abram tell Lot?
You pick. Choose.
Yeah. He gave him the choice, didn't he? He said, you choose, you choose. Such a gracious man. He had God's promises to bless him, so he probably wasn't concerned about that. So he said, you choose. The whole land is before you. You choose. If you go one way, then I'll go the other way. It doesn't make any difference. And so what did Lot do?
But also civilization he chose.
Yeah, but he chose what looked really good, right? He saw that it was great looking. It was everything that he wanted. It was just great, right? So it was like the land of Egypt. It tells us something, doesn't it? So he chose for himself all the valley of the Jordan, and Lot journeyed eastward, and they separated from each other. And so where did Abram settle? Okay, in the land of Canaan. And so after Abram separated from Lot, then the Lord spoke to Abram again, didn't he? What did he tell him? Okay. Yeah, lift up your eyes and look. Look everywhere as far as you can see. As far as you can see, I will give that land to you and to your descendants for how long?
Forever.
Forever. And once again, there's that key word, which is what? Well, forever, but descendants, right? He's going to give it to his descendants. And, of course, he had no descendants at this point. I will make your descendants as the dust of the earth. So if anyone can number the dust of the earth, then your descendants can also be numbered. Rise, walk about the land through its length and its breadth, for I will give it to you. Okay, and there he built an altar to the Lord. Okay, so we have the separation.
But kind of a personal note for Abram. Abram at this time. It's a continuation of him separating from something.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And after that separation, God does something bigger. But there is a devotion to what God is saying,
mm-hmm,
as he separates by faith. And you brought out chapter 11. Is it a coincidence that chapter 11 is all about Babel? And then we go to 12 at the very beginning. God has a new program.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The earth is so evil already again. And then he's supposed to leave his family behind, but who does he take with him?
Lot.
He takes Lot.
Didn't his father?
And his father.
He died. His father, Abram's father, died before God spoke to him in chapter 12. He died in Haran, and then the Lord spoke to Abram. So I don't think so, but I know he did take his nephew, and he was probably raising his nephew. He probably had the brother had probably died, but still, you know, the Lot gets into some trouble, doesn't he? And yet we see, you know, if you see the commentary on Lot, it says righteous Lot had his righteous soul tormented by living in Sodom and Gomorrah. We know that he wasn't just going along with the status quo there. Okay.
And it's like, we don't know to what degree God is requiring him to separate. It may have been okay to take those
Lot
other people.
As a member of his household. Yeah, it could be. Regardless, we see that at this point they are separating. The separation, like I said, continues, and God comes again and speaks to him again and says, okay, now this is the land. Lot's taken that. This is the land that you're going to have. And then in chapter 14, what happens there? Okay, so there's the war of the kings, the battle of the kings, and Lot and his family and his possessions, they're all taken, right? It said, they took Lot, Abram's nephew, and his possessions, and departed, for he was living where?
Sodom.
Okay, in Sodom. And we see this battle, and then a fugitive, came and told Abram the Hebrew. So Abram was a Hebrew, and he was living by the oaks of Mamre, and they came and told him the story that Lot had been taken. And so what did he do? Okay, what does this tell you about the wealth of Abram at this point? Substantial. How many trained men that were born in his household did he have? 318. And these are only the men that are trained for war. So these are the men born in his household who were trained to be soldiers, trained to defend. It wasn't including the women, the children, anyone else. So this is a huge household to Abraham. He is quite a mighty man in his day. And so he takes them, and what does he do? He defeats them, doesn't he? He, with his men, defeat the enemy, and they bring back not just Lot, but what? Okay, all the spoil that these guys have accumulated, they bring it all back. They bring it all back, and the women, and the people. So I'm sure he was quite a hero in that area, because he brought it all back. So who does he meet then after the return? Okay, here we have the mystery man, Melchizedek, who they weren't mature enough to learn about because they were dull of hearing and they were lazy and sluggish, but now we're going to see something about Melchizedek a little bit here, and really this is about it, so listen up. Okay, and Melchizedek, here he comes on the stage. He's the king of where?
Salem,
which is more than likely Jerusalem. He's the king of Salem. He brings out bread and wine. Now, he was a priest of who?
Most High God.
Okay, the God Most High, El Elyon. This is the first time this name is mentioned here. He is the priest of God Most High. And he comes to Abram, and he blessed him and said, blessed be Abraham, you just want to say Abraham, right? Sarah. Blessed be Abram of God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand. And what does it say Abram did? Okay, he gave him a tenth of all the spoils. He had all these spoils from the battle. He gave him a tenth of all the spoils. And there we go. The king of Sodom said to Abram, give the people to me and take the goods for yourself. And Abram said to the king of Sodom, I have sworn to the Lord God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, I will not take a thread or a sandal thong or anything that is yours, lest you should say, I have made Abram rich. Nothing but the food to take care of the men that did this. And so we see Abram paying tithes to Melchizedek, who is not only a priest, but he's also a king. And do we ever see Melchizedek again? In Hebrews, he pops up in Hebrews, yeah. Okay, so there we have that introduction for us to Melchizedek, and then also the understanding by looking at him at the situation of how great Abram was. He was a mighty man, and he was very, very, very blessed by God in all of his wealth. Of course, God had told him he would bless him and make him great, and he was becoming quite great. Okay, so going on from there then, we go to chapter 15. We have God, or Abram, talking to Melchizedek and proving his faithfulness and his promise to the Lord and not taking what he felt wasn't his. And then we have God intervening in his life again in chapter 15, verses 1 through 18. And what do we see here?
That's the covenant.
Okay, so it's after these things. So after these things with Melchizedek and after these things with the kings, the word of the Lord came to Abram. How?
In a vision.
Okay, in a vision. And what does he tell him?
I am a shield and exceeding great reward.
Yeah, it says, do not fear. I am a shield to you, and your reward will be very great. And what does Abram ask? Of course. What's that?
How about Eleazar?
Well, he says, okay, you've made these promises to me, and I'm going to be a great nation. You promised me that. But, he says, I don't have any descendants. I don't have any. The only person I have to leave all of this to is my servant, Eleazar. He's the only one I have. And he says, you've given me no offspring. No one in my house is my heir. So what did the Lord tell him? Yeah, he says, Eleazar is not going to be your heir. He's not going to be your heir. But one who comes forth from your own body, he shall be your heir. So there's still that promise, isn't there? That there's going to be a great nation. It's going to be through one who comes naturally through Abram's own body. He will be the heir. And then he takes them outside. And what do they look at? Okay, the stars. He's already talked about the sand as they're in the desert. Look at the sand. Can you count the sand? No. Okay. Now they're out there in the middle of nowhere looking at the stars. And can you imagine what the stars would have been like? Because when we see the stars, we don't see hardly any because there's so much light, isn't there, that we have competing with the stars. And he could see them all. He could see all those stars. He says, if you could count the stars, then what? Yeah, that's how many descendants you're going to have. So it's an innumerable amount of descendants that Abraham.
So how old is he here? About 85-ish, maybe?
I think he was close to 9.
Ishmael is not 15 yet. So.
No, well, Ishmael isn't born yet.
Okay.
That's in the next chapter, which we didn't look at for some reason. But he's, I would guess he's, what, maybe getting close to...
He's 86 according to chapter 16:16.
Oh, great. Thank you. I knew it would tell us your son. Oh, there it is. Yep, the last verse of chapter 16. 86 years old when Hagar was born. Or when Ishmael was born from Hagar. Okay, so God promises him that he is going to have an heir. And if he could count the stars, that's how many it would be. And what does it say then in verse 6? What did Abram do? Okay, he believed God. This is the first time, really, that whole concept of faith and belief is even mentioned in the Bible. Then he believed in the Lord, and he reckoned it to him as what?
Righteousness.
As righteousness. So when was Abram righteous in the sight of God? When was he saved?
Right there.
Right here, when he believed God. He believed what God said against anything that his humanity probably told him to believe, as old as he was, right? But he believed God. And he said to him, I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to possess it. And he said, O Lord, how may I know that I shall possess it? So he said to him, bring me the animals, right? Bring me a 3-year-old heifer, a 3-year-old female goat, a 3-year-old ram, a turtle dove, and a young pigeon. And he brought all of these to him. And what did Abram do? Okay, cut them in two. He knew the process. He was going to make what? What was God going to make with him? A covenant. Yeah. So he cut them in two, and when they cut them in two, he laid each half opposite the other. Didn't cut the birds. They were too small, so he didn't cut the birds. And then he had to watch over them. And so what did Abram do as the day was ending? Okay, he kept the birds of prey. He beat them away to keep them away from the animals, didn't he? And as the night was falling, what happened to Abram? He fell into a deep sleep, and what else? Yeah, terror and darkness fell upon him, a great darkness. So what was he experiencing? I think the presence of God, just the terror. I think of the fear of the Lord that we feel if we feel God's presence. So he experienced that. And as he was sleeping, God said to Abram, know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed 400 years. What land was that?
Egypt.
Okay, Egypt. He was telling them there's going to come a time when all these people that he was going to give them are going to be enslaved. But I will also judge the nation whom they will serve, and afterward they will come out with many possessions. And you think about how they plundered the land of Egypt. And as for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace, and you shall be buried at a good old age. Then, in the fourth generation, they shall return here, for the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete. Well, what does that have to do with anything? What was God going to use them to do when they came back to the land?
To judge them.
Okay, to judge the Amorites, right? To judge the inhabitants of the land. We know they were terrible idol worshippers, and God was going to use the people of Israel to get rid of the people in the land. But their iniquity wasn't ready for that yet. It would take a few years yet.
It just shows us God's mercy and grace toward heathens who he continues maybe to offer truth to.
Yeah, they didn't have to let their iniquity build up, did they? No, God gave them time, but at the end of 400 years, we know that they...
And you know they were hearing about all this stuff. They're little gossips just like everybody else.
Oh, yeah, just like when they came out of the land of Egypt and we saw Rahab and she'd heard. She'd heard what had gone on. So they knew. All right, so he says it's not time yet, basically is what he's saying. It's not time for the land to be taken yet. So it and it came about when the sun had set, it was very dark, and behold, there appeared what? Okay. There appeared a smoking oven and a flaming torch which passed between the pieces. And we kind of see the Trinity here, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
Who's the Father?
The furnace.
Okay, the smoking oven or the furnace. And who's the Holy Spirit?
The torch.
And where's the sun?
The pieces.
the pieces. So we see that picture there. And on that day, God made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your descendants I have given this land, from the river of Egypt as far as the great river, the river Euphrates, the Kenite, the Kenizzite, and the Kadmonite, and the Hittite, and the Perizzite, and the Rephaim, and the Amorite, and the Canaanite, and the Girgashite, and the Jebusite.
God so, did it all.
God
Abraham
did it all.
Did nothing.
Nothing. Yeah, because when they passed, if you were going to make a covenant with another person, if I was going to make a covenant with you, and we cut all those pieces up, who would walk between the pieces?
You would.
You'd both pass, because that we would both bear the conditions of the covenant. If you defaulted, then, you know, what would happen to you?
Death. That's
death.
What you're, what
right.
And made a covenant, it's cut the covenant.
Covenant. Right. Very important, the blood. And so this happened, but Abram slept while God alone passed between the pieces. So the conditions of the covenant were all borne by the Lord himself. He made the covenant. Everything was on him.
And I've got a note here somewhere, probably from reading, Kay has that covenant book, that they probably walked in a figure eight, like the infinity.
Oh, like
forever.
Interesting.
Cool.
That's a very important symbol. All right, so we have God making the covenant then, the actual blood covenant with Abram in chapter 15. And then in chapter 16, which we didn't look at, what happened in chapter 16? Kind of add a little bit to the story, which I think is very to help God along. So Abram believed God, didn't he? We know that he believed God. He believed that God would do what he said. And yet, did even Abram have a place where he stumbled in that belief? Didn't give it up, but what did they, in essence, do?
Oh, Hagar.
Yeah, Hagar. Yeah.
Could this be a little bit like Adam listened to Eve?
Oh, I would think so. Women are very powerful in their influence over their men, aren't they? And Sarah convinced him this would be the good thing to do. And we know that Ishmael was born. And so Abram indeed had a son, but he wasn't the son, was he? He was not the one that the promises were going to come from. And we saw that in Romans. Okay, so now when Abram was 90 years old in chapter 17... what happens here? You looked at verses 15 through 21.
Sarah.
Okay.
The circumcision, though, is the...
Right. He gives them the sign of circumcision, and they were to circumcise, because God had told them, my covenant is with you, and your name shall... I don't know why you didn't look at this in our passage, but your name is no longer what? Abram. Now we can actually call him Abraham, because now his name is Abraham.
Well, God breathed on him. They added that.
Right, the part of God's name. And I will make you a father of multitudes of nations, and I will make you exceedingly fruitful, and I will make nations of you, and kings shall come forth from you, and I will establish my covenant between me and you and your what? Yeah, your descendants after you throughout their generations for an everlasting covenant to be God to you and to your descendants after you. And I will give to you and your descendants after you the land of your sojournings, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. So it wasn't just the land. Who did they get when they got the land? They got God himself, didn't they? He was going to be their God throughout all generations, forever. Yes, he is the great reward.
In the beginning of this chapter, he introduces himself as, I am God Almighty. Walk before me and be blameless. I'm Almighty. I'm going to bring life to your dead body.
That's right. And he did, didn't he? He brought life from the dead. But that's the first time Abraham will really see that. The life coming from the dead is through his dead body. Yeah. So he tells them, gives them a sign of circumcision, that's their sign of the covenant. And then in verse 15, it's as for Sarah, your wife. What's her name going to be?
Sarah.
Okay, Sarah. And I will bless her, indeed I will give you a son by her. Then I will bless her, and she shall be a mother of nations, kings of peoples shall come from her. Then Abraham fell on his face and laughed. I think he was laughing in derision. No, I think he's laughing in joy that God had not forgotten the promise he'd made for him. Though, was he a little bit, still a little skeptical? Yeah? Will a child be born to a man 100 years old And will Sarah, who is 90 years old, bear a son? Well, and then what did he say? I guess it was a joy. Maybe it was derision or skepticism, because what does Abram say to the Lord?
Well, that Ishmael might live before they
Yeah, did. Maybe you should consider Ishmael. Look how old I am. Look how old I am. Because no, Sarah, your wife.
Do you think that possibly Abraham had thought that Ishmael was going to be that son and had gotten attached to him that way and invested in him because he said from his own body, he said that
Sarah would be the one?
Yeah.
It's possible. We know he loved Ishmael. Ishmael was his son.
Yeah.
Ishmael was his son. And for all he knew, you know, maybe there was not going to be another son. Yeah. I mean, he was Abraham. Human, right? Human. We have very limited understanding as human beings, don't we? And even though he had the promises of God, how would it all work out? Did he understand how it was all going to work out? Well, God really clarified, it's going to be Sarah. It's going to be Sarah, your wife, the one who has the my name upon her. She is the one that the son is going to come through. It's going to be through her. And he says, as for Ishmael, I have heard you. I have. You know, he loves Ishmael too, didn't he? Yes, I will bless him, make him fruitful, and will multiply him exceedingly. And he shall become the father of 12 princes, and I'll make him a great nation. But my covenant I will establish with who? With Isaac. Okay, now we have a name for the son. Whom Sarah will bear to you at this season next year. Next year. Okay. So then God left. He went up from Abram. And Abraham did everything he's supposed to. He had everybody circumcised. And Abraham was 99 years old, and he was circumcised. Of course, the heir couldn't come until he was circumcised. So he was circumcised. Okay. And then we know that there's the appearance of the men to... Do we look at that? No, we didn't look at that. But we know that the three men came and had a visit, the angel of the Lord among them, and said again, Sarah is going to bear a son. Next year, she's going to have one. And, of course, how did Sarah react? We all know the story. She laughed. Huh, how could that be? Could that be that I, at this age, could have a son that I could bring joy to my husband and give him a son? Could it be? Okay. And then in chapter 21, what do we see happening there? Okay, so the Lord took note of Sarah as he had said, and the Lord did for Sarah as he had promised. So Sarah conceived and bore a son to Abraham in his old age, in her old age, I will say, at the appointed time of which God had spoken to him. And so what did Abraham name the son?
Isaac.
And he circumcised his son as he was told. And how old was Abraham when his son was born?
100 years old.
And what does Isaac mean?
It means
laughter, doesn't it? Yeah. And Sarah laughed again. She was laughing with delight. God has made laughter for me, and everyone here will laugh with me. Isn't it interesting that God chose that name for him? He named him Laughter. Okay, so as he was growing up, then... What happened? Well, first we have the separation with
Ishmael.
Yeah, with Hagar and Ishmael. She was not going to be an heir for the son. All right. And then in chapter 22, we have another test. And do you think this was a test for Abraham as well? When God basically sent Ishmael away. It was a test for him because he loved his son, didn't he? He loved his son. He had had him for 12 years or so before Isaac came, and he was his son. And so he said to do whatever Sarah said to take. So Abraham rose early and took her away, and she left. Okay, then we know what happens with her. All right, and then chapter 22, we have the big test, don't we? The big test that God is going to test Abraham. And it is big on many levels, isn't it? What does he say to him? Yeah. First he calls him and he says, here I am. He knows the voice of the Lord, doesn't he? He knows God's voice. And he said, take now your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac. So was he his only son?
covenant son.
He was his only covenant son. He was the son of the promise, wasn't he? He already told him that the promises were not going to come through Ishmael. So really, Ishmael was as good as dead as far as the promises were concerned. But he told him to take his son, your only son, whom you love. Go to the land of Moriah, offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I will tell you. So Abraham gets this message, and I would imagine he gets it at night when he's laying down to go to sleep. The Lord speaks to him in a dream. And so what is it? Does Abraham try to barter with God, buy time, anything like that?
He got up early in the morning.
Doesn't that just get you? I mean, his only son whom he loved, the one whom all the promises of God were wound up in, take him and offer him as a burnt offering. And he doesn't even say, well, maybe we should wait until we have a party for him, or, you know, everybody can come say goodbye, or we could do all these things that we would think. But no, he gets up early in the morning. Of course, you think he slept that night? I just can't imagine he did. Rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, took two of his young men with him and Isaac his son, and split the wood for the burnt offering, arose and went to the place which God had told him. So he got up early. He knew how far he had to go. He took off. How long did he travel?
3 days.
3 days. Now, how old is Abraham at this point, do you think? He was 100 years old when Isaac was born.
Maybe 112 or something.
Yeah, I would say that. Maybe 112, 113, because Isaac is a young man. He's not a child. He's a young man. So he rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, and left. Third day, Abraham raised his eyes and saw the place from a distance. And then what did Abraham say to his young men that were traveling with him?
Stay here.
Yeah. We'll be back. You stay here with the donkey, and I and the lad will go yonder, and we'll worship, and we will return. So we'll be back. We'll return to you. So we already see so much faith in Abraham just from the very beginning, don't we? His following the Lord's directions without any talking back, you know, and doing it right away, getting right to it. And then that faith that he had that I'm going to go do this, but we're going to be back. We're going to come back. We're going to go worship the Lord. And just saying that, isn't that something that he even said that? That here God had made all these promises to him, and then he was telling him to go and kill his son who had the promises all embedded in him. And he said, we're going to go worship this God. We're going to go worship. So much here. So Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering, laid it on who?
Isaac.
On Isaac, his son. We see the cross there, don't we? The wood being laid upon the son, his only son. Took the fire in his hand and the knife, and the two of them walked on together. Now what does Isaac say?
Where is
the sacrifice? We have the wood, we have the fire, we have everything we need, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering? And what did Abraham respond? Jehovah Jireh, right?
Don't say that today.
Yep. God will provide himself the lamb for the burnt offering, my son. So God would provide, and that word for isn't really in the original, is that God will provide himself the lamb. So he's looking ahead, even at this point, to the cross, isn't he? That there's going to come a lamb, and is Isaac that lamb?
No.
But there need to be a substitutionary death, even for Isaac, and God is going to provide that lamb for him. And so they walked on together, and they came to the place of to which God had told him, and Abraham built the altar there, and he arranged the wood, and then he did what? Yeah, he bound his son Isaac, and he laid him on top of the wood.
And Isaac evidently wasn't fighting him.
No, and could he have? Here you've got a 120-year-old practically man. Yep. Yep.
I got to teach this one time to my sixth graders. I was able to sneak it in when we studied Ivanhoe. And I had Muslim kids in my class, and a boy told me that they believed that it was Ishmael that was sacrificed or was taken up the mount.
Oh, dear.
That's
interesting. Well, you know, you look at the faith of even of Isaac here, right? But if you go back to Genesis 18, when the Lord is talking to the other angel, Lord is talking to the men that he was with, he said, shall I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do? For I have chosen him in order that he may command his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice in order that the Lord may bring upon Abraham what he has spoken about him. And so Abraham was specifically chosen because he was a faithful man who would teach his children how to obey and live a righteous life. And so we have Isaac, who's his child. And so Isaac, he could have fought Abraham. He could have fought him off, but he himself was a faithful son, wasn't he? He was an obedient child, and so he did not. He understood somehow what God was doing and that God was to be honored in everything, no matter what. And so he lifts his hand to slay his son, and what happens? Yeah, we have the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. He said, here I am, just like he said in verse 1, right? Here I am. I'm still here. It says, do not stretch out your hand against the lad and do nothing to him, for now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. So who is the angel of the Lord that was speaking to Abraham? It's the pre-incarnate Christ, isn't it? It's the pre-incarnate Christ speaking to him. You have not withheld your son from me. And Abraham raised his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him a ram caught in the thicket by his horns. And Abraham went, took the ram, and offered him for a burnt offering in the place of his son. And so for the first time, we see the idea of substitutionary death. Because if the ram hadn't died, who would have had to die? Isaac. And so we see that ram sacrificed for the life of Isaac. And then the Lord, Abraham named the name of the place, the Lord will provide. In the mount of the Lord, it will be provided. So think about Calvary. Hmm?
Yeah, that's it. That's
the mount of the Lord.
Jerusalem.
Yep.
The full mount. Mm-hmm. And the neat thing is, there's a precept study that is on the names of God. And in this particular passage, it says three words are mentioned for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
You remember.
Mm-hmm.
You
Which
remember
is the first one?
Love.
Love.
Uh-huh. Worship.
Yes. Worship. What was the other one?
Obey.
Ah, mm-hmm. I've got them all written down. Yep. Mm-hmm.
First mention.
First mention, love, worship, and obey. And the first time we see substitutionary death.
Yeah, where's obey? I
didn't
have that.
Let's see.
Love is in verse 2.
Mm-hmm. Worship is in
five. And obey is in 18. Obey my voice.
Oh, yep, wow. You have obeyed my voice. And because of that, once again, God's promising again, isn't he? It's indeed, I will greatly bless you, and I will multiply your seed as the stars of the heavens, as the sand on which is the seashore, and your seed shall possess the gate of their enemies. And in your seed, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because you have done what? Obeyed my voice. So God was testing Abraham to see what was in him. And did God know, as Ruth heard, did God know what he was going to find when he tested Abraham? He did, didn't he? He chose him very carefully. He was a careful choice. And so because of that, then God's promises were going to be fulfilled. All right. And then what do we see in Romans chapter 4? It gives a little bit of light to Abraham's story.
Oh, the resurrection. He believed he'd bring him back.
Right.
How could he raise Isaac in 19?
How could he say to those two men that were with him, two young men, we're going to go worship, and we're going to come back. What did he really believe in Romans 17? What did he say? He had seen him bring life from the dead, right? And then what life? Because he was as good as dead, and Sarah was as good as dead, and that gave him confidence to know that. And we see that in Hebrews 11. It kind of continues a little train of thought there. What does it say in Hebrews 11? What did he know? Yeah, that would be that. Right. So it was all bound up in Isaac. And he had seen that God had really given life to the dead when he gave Isaac in the first place. So because of that, he was confident that God could do what?
Raise
him from the dead. And so Abraham's faith was so strong in what God could do that he was able to take it to the point of the knife, knowing that even if God didn't stop him, that God would do what? That he would raise him from the dead, and that there would still be descendants from Isaac, because God had told him and he believed it. He was tested and said he received the promises of offering up his only begotten son, because all in him all his descendants would be called. And he considered that God is able to raise men even from the dead, from which he also received him back as a type. What was he a type of?
Christ being resurrected.
Yeah, Jesus being raised from the dead to be the first fruits, the firstborn, because God was able to raise the dead. And so we see that just wonderful picture in the whole story of Abraham. And so he is used as that example of diligence, that they are to imitate the life of Abraham, because without any doubt, he was the example of faith that they could emulate. Because even though things looked terrible, for you know, God had promised it, but it didn't look good, humanly speaking, did it? At many points. But God was faithful, and Abraham clung to the promise, and he held on to that. He was not sluggish. He was not slothful, but he was patient, and he kept the faith. And so he said to be there to imitate his faith just like them, because God, even showing to Abraham, he wasn't even showing to Abraham what was going to happen. Who was he also showing something to? It wasn't just for Abraham to learn these lessons about God's provision. Who was it? It was for us. We are the heirs of the promise, aren't we? We are the heirs of the promise. And he wanted to show the unchangeableness of his purpose. And because of that, he made an oath. Did God have to ever swear an oath? If he said something, did he ever have to swear an oath? But what was the practice of men in those days and in these days? Yeah, they'd swear by, you know, by their grandmother, by God. You know, they would swear to show that there was someone higher, there's a higher authority here. And so God didn't have to swear because he is the highest authority, isn't he? But he swore by things that could not be changed, that we would know that it is impossible for God to lie. And so when Jesus entered that behind the veil for us, what do we know for certain? What do we know?
He's going to do what he said.
Yeah, he is our sure hope. He's the anchor behind the veil that anchors our soul to him, knowing that if God said that he is going to continue to work out our salvation to the point where we are someday glorified, can we be sure of that? Yeah, we have our anchor within the veil, don't we? We know that if he's there, we will be with him someday. He said so, didn't he? Where I am, what? There you will be also. So we have that anchor that holds within the veil. And that picture you gave us last week was just so great. I love that. Oh, wasn't you well? It was still great. It was great. So this is the story. And next week we're going to look at the order of Melchizedek. But we know that Jesus is the one who gives us eternal salvation. And if we do what? Hold fast. If we don't drift away, if we hold fast our confidence firm until the end, then we know that we're part of his household, don't we? And we know that we have a high priest who will hold us forever. And we look at Abraham, he could have thought maybe he slipped away when he's tried to figure it out on his own. But God was holding him fast, wasn't he? He had the anchor that was holding him, and he did not slip away so as to fall. So there we have it, the story of Abraham. Isn't that just so great? Don't we love the Old Testament? Yes, we do. Yeah.
I was going to say, I struggled with this word promise and oath.
Uh-huh.
And looking at it.